these bastards. A government, half savage and half corrupt, was almost dissolved, and the tributary dukes and provincial counts and the territorial lords were tempted to despise the weakness of the monarch and to imitate the ambition of the mayor. Among these independent chiefs, one of the boldest and most successful was Eudes, Duke of Aquitaine, who in the southern provinces of Gaul usurped the authority and even the title of king. The Goths, the Gascons, and the Franks assembled under the standard of this Christian hero. He repelled the first invasion of the Saracens, and Zama, lieutenant of the Caliph, lost his army and his life under the walls of Toulouse. The ambition of his successors was stimulated by revenge. They repassed the Pyrenees with the means and the resolution of conquest. The advantageous situation which had recommended Narbonne as the first Roman colony was again chosen by the Muslims. They claimed the province of Septimania, or Languedoc, as a just dependence of the Spanish monarchy. The vineyards of Gascony and the city of Bordeaux were possessed by the sovereign of Damascus and Samarkand, and the south of France, from the mouth of the Garonne to that of the Rhone, assumed the manners and religion of Arabia. But these narrow limits were scorned by the spirit of Abd al-Rahman, or Abderrahim, who had been restored by the Caliph Hashem to the wishes of the soldiers and people of Spain. That veteran and daring commander adjudged to the obedience of the Prophet whatever yet remained of France or of Europe, and prepared to execute the sentence at the head of a formidable host in the full confidence of surmounting all opposition either of nature or of man. His first care was to suppress a domestic rebel who commanded the most important passes of the Pyrenees. Manusa, a Moorish chief, had accepted the alliance of the Duke of Aquitaine, and Eudes, from a motive of private or public interest, devoted his beauteous daughter to the embraces of the African misbeliever. But the strongest fortresses of Cerdagne were invested by superior force. The rebel was overtaken and slain in the mountains, and his widow was sent a captive to Damascus to gratify the desires, or more probably the vanity, of the commander of the faithful. From the Pyrenees, Abderrahim proceeded without delay to the passage of the Rhone and the siege of Arles. An army of Christians attempted the relief of the city. The tombs of their leaders were yet visible in the 13th century, and many thousands of their dead bodies were carried down the rapid stream into the Mediterranean Sea. The arms of Abderrahim were not less successful on the side of the ocean. He passed without opposition the Garonne and Dordogne, which unite their waters in the Gulf of Bordeaux, but he found, beyond those rivers, the camp of the intrepid Eudes, who had formed a second army and sustained a second defeat, so fatal to the Christians that, according to their sad confession, God alone could reckon the number of the slain. The victorious Saracen overran the provinces of Aquitaine, whose Gallic names are disguised rather than lost in the modern appellations of Perigord, Saintonge, and Poitou. His standards were planted on the walls, or at least before the gates, of Tours and of Seine, and his detachments overspread the kingdom of Burgundy as far as the well-known cities of Lyon and Besançon. The memory of these devastations, for Abderrahim did not spare the country or the people, was long preserved by tradition, and the invasion of France by the Moors or Mohammedans affords the groundwork of those fables which have been so wildly disfigured in the romances of chivalry, and so elegantly adorned by the Italian muse. In the decline of society and art, the deserted cities could supply a slender booty to the Saracens. Their richest spoil was found in the churches and monasteries, which they stripped of their ornaments and delivered to the flames, and the tutelar saints, both Hilary of Poitiers and Martin of Tours, forgot their miraculous powers in the defense of their own sepulchres. A victorious line of march had been prolonged above 1,000 miles from the Rock of Gibraltar to the banks of the Loire. The repetition of an equal space would have carried the Saracens to the confines of Poland and the highlands of Scotland. The Rhine is not more impassable than the Nile or Euphrates, and the Arab fleet might have sailed without a naval combat into the mouth of the Thames. Perhaps the interpretation of the Koran would now be taught in the schools of Oxford, and her pulpits might demonstrate to a circumcised people the sanctity and truth of the revelation of Muhammad. From such calamities was Christendom delivered by the genius and fortune of one man. Charles, the illegitimate son of the elder Pepin, was content with the titles of mayor or duke of the Franks, but he deserved to become the father of a line of kings. In a laborious administration of 24 years, he restored and supported the dignity of the throne, and the rebels of Germany and Gaul were successively crushed by the activity of a warrior who, in the same campaign, could display his banner on the Elbe, the Rhone, and the shores of the ocean. In the public danger, he was summoned by the voice of his country, and his rival, the Duke of Aquitaine, was reduced to appear among the fugitives and suppliants. "Alas," exclaimed the Franks, "what a misfortune! What an indignity! We have long heard of the name and conquests of the Arabs. We were apprehensive of their attack from the east. They have now conquered Spain, and invade our country on the side of the west. Yet their numbers, and since they have no buckler, their arms are inferior to our own." "If you follow my advice," replied the prudent mayor of the palace, "you will not interrupt their march, nor precipitate your attack. They are like a torrent, which it is dangerous to stem in its career. The thirst of riches and the consciousness of success redouble their valor, and valor is of more avail than arms or numbers. Be patient till they have loaded themselves with the encumbrance of wealth. The possession of wealth will divide their counsels and assure your victory." This subtle policy is perhaps a refinement of the Arabian writers, and the situation of Charles will suggest a more narrow and selfish motive of procrastination. The secret desire of humbling the pride and wasting the provinces of the rebel Duke of Aquitaine. It is yet more probable that the delays of Charles were inevitable and reluctant. A standing army was unknown under the first and second race. More than half the kingdom was now in the hands of the Saracens. According to their respective situation, the Franks of Neustria and Austrasia were too conscious or too careless of the impending danger, and the voluntary aids of the Gepidi and Germans were separated by a long interval from the standard of the Christian general. No sooner had he collected his forces than he sought and found the enemy in the center of France, between Tours and Poitiers. His well-conducted march was covered with a range of hills, and Abderrahim appears to have been surprised by his unexpected presence. The nations of Asia, Africa, and Europe advanced with equal ardor to an encounter which would change the history of the world. In the 6 first days of desultory combat, the horsemen and archers of the East maintained their advantage. But in the closer onset of the 7th day, the Orientals were oppressed by the strength and stature of the Germans, who, with stout hearts and iron hands, asserted the civil and religious freedom of their posterity. The epithet of Martel, the Hammer, which has been added to the name of Charles, is expressive of his weighty and irresistible strokes. The valor of Eudes was excited by resentment and emulation, and their companions, in the eye of history, are the true peers and paladins of French cavalry. After a bloody field in which Abderrahim was slain, the Saracens, in the close of the evening, retired to their camp. In the disorder and despair of the night, the various tribes of Yemen and Damascus, of Africa and Spain, were provoked to turn their arms against each other. The remains of their host were suddenly dissolved, and each emir consulted his safety by a hasty and separate retreat. At the dawn of the day, the stillness of a hostile camp was suspected by the victorious Christians. On the report of their spies, they ventured to explore the riches of the vacant tents. But if we accept some celebrated relics, a small portion of the spoil was restored to the innocent and lawful owners. The joyful tidings were soon diffused over the Catholic world, and the monks of Italy could affirm and believe that 350 or 375,000 of the Mohammedans had been crushed by the hammer of Charles, while no more than 1,500 Christians were slain in the field of Tours. But this incredible tale is sufficiently disproved by the caution of the French general, who apprehended the snares and accidents of a pursuit, and dismissed his German allies to their native forests. The inactivity of a conqueror betrays the loss of strength and blood, and the most cruel execution is inflicted not in the ranks of battle, but on the backs of a flying enemy. Yet the victory of the Franks was complete and final. Aquitaine was recovered by the arms of Eudes. The Arabs never resumed the conquest of Gaul, and they were soon driven beyond the Pyrenees by Charles Martel and his valiant race. It might have been expected that the savior of Christendom would have been canonized, or at least applauded by the gratitude of the clergy, who are indebted to his sword for their present existence. But in the public distress, the mayor of the palace had been compelled to apply the riches, or at least the revenues, of the bishops and abbots to the relief of the state and the reward of the soldiers. His merits were forgotten. His sacrilege alone was remembered, and in an epistle to a Carlovingian prince, a Gallic synod presumes to declare that his ancestor was damned, that on the opening of his tomb the spectators were affrighted by a smell of fire and the aspect of a horrid dragon, and that a saint of the times was indulged with a pleasant vision of the soul and body of Charles Martel burning to all eternity in the abyss of hell. The loss of an army or a province in the Western world was less painful to the court of Damascus than the rise and progress of a domestic competitor. Except among the Syrians, the caliphs of the house of Umayyah had never been the objects of the public favor. The life of Muhammad recorded their perseverance in idolatry and rebellion. Their conversion had been reluctant, their elevation irregular and factious, and their throne was cemented with the most holy and noble blood of Arabia. The best of their race, the pious Omar, was dissatisfied with his own title. Their personal virtues were insufficient to justify a departure from the order of succession, and the eyes and wishes of the faithful were turned towards the line of Hashim and the kindred of the Apostle of God. Of these, the Fatimites were either rash or pusillanimous, but the descendants of Abbas cherished, with courage and discretion, the hopes of their rising fortunes. From an obscure residence in Syria, they secretly dispatched their agents and missionaries, who preached in the eastern provinces their hereditary indefeasible right, and Muhammad, the son of Ali, the son of Abdallah, the son of Abbas, the uncle of the prophet, gave audience to the deputies of Khorasan, and accepted their free gift of 400,000 pieces of gold. After the death of Muhammad, the oath of allegiance was administered in the name of his son Ibrahim to a numerous band of votaries who expected only a signal and a leader. And the governor of Khorasan continued to deplore his fruitless admonitions and the deadly slumber of the caliphs of Damascus, till he himself, with all his adherents, was driven from the city and palace of Maru by the rebellious arms of Abu Muslim. That maker of kings, the author, as he is named, of the call of the Abbasides, was at length rewarded for his presumption of merit with the usual gratitude of courts. A mean, perhaps a foreign extraction, could not repress the aspiring energy of Abu Muslim. Jealous of his wives, liberal of his wealth, prodigal of his own blood and of that of others, he could boast with pleasure and possibly with truth that he had destroyed 600,000 of his enemies. And such was the intrepid gravity of his mind and countenance that he was never seen to smile except on a day of battle. In the visible separation of parties, the green was consecrated to the Fatimites. The Umayyads were distinguished by the white, and the black, as the most adverse, was naturally adopted by the Abbasides. Their turbans and garments were stained with that gloomy color. Two black standards on pike staves, 9 cubits long, were borne aloft in the van of Abu Muslim, and their allegorical names of the night and the shadow obscurely represented the indissoluble union and perpetual succession of the line of Hashim. From the Indus to the Euphrates, the East was convulsed by the quarrel of the white and the black factions. The Abbasides were most frequently victorious, but their public success was clouded by the personal misfortune of their chief. The court of Damascus, awakening from a long slumber, resolved to prevent the pilgrimage of Mecca, which Ibrahim had undertaken with a splendid retinue to recommend himself at once to the favor of the prophet and of the people. A detachment of cavalry intercepted his march and arrested his person, and the unhappy Ibrahim, snatched away from the promise of untasted royalty, expired in iron fetters in the dungeons of Haran. His two younger brothers, Safah and Al-Mansur, eluded the search of the tyrant, and lay concealed at Kufa, till the zeal of the people and the approach of his eastern friends allowed them to expose their persons to the impatient public. On Friday, in the dress of a caliph, in the colors of the sect, Safah proceeded with religious and military pomp to the mosque. Attending the pulpit, he prayed and preached as the lawful successor of Muhammad. And after his departure, his kinsmen bound a willing people by an oath of fidelity. But it was on the banks of the Zab, and not in the mosque of Kufa, that this important controversy was determined. Every advantage appeared to be on the side of the white faction, the authority of established government, an army of 120,000 soldiers against a sixth part of that number, and the presence and merit of the Caliph Mervan, the 14th and last of the House of Omiyah. Before his accession to the throne, he had deserved, by his Georgian warfare, the honorable epithet of the Ass of Mesopotamia, and he might have been ranked amongst the greatest princes, had not, says Abul Feda, the eternal order decreed that moment for the ruin of his family, a decree against which all human fortitude and prudence must struggle in vain. The orders of Mervan were mistaken or disobeyed. The return of his horse, from which he had dismounted on a necessary occasion, impressed the belief of his death, and the enthusiasm of the black squadrons was ably conducted by Abdallah, the uncle of his competitor. After an irretrievable defeat, the caliph escaped to Mosul, but the colors of the Abbasides were displayed from the rampart. He suddenly repassed the Tigris, cast a melancholy look on his palace of Haran, crossed the Euphrates, abandoned the fortifications of Damascus, and, without halting in Palestine, pitched his last and fatal camp at Busir, on the banks of the Nile. His speed was urged by the incessant diligence of Abdallah, who in every step of the pursuit acquired strength and reputation. The remains of the white faction were finally vanquished in Egypt, and the lance which terminated the life and anxiety of Mervan was not less welcome perhaps to the unfortunate than to the victorious chief. The merciless inquisition of the conqueror eradicated the most distant branches of the hostile race. Their bones were scattered, their memory was accursed, and the martyrdom of Hussein was abundantly revenged on the posterity of his tyrants. Fourscore of the Ommiades, who had yielded to the faith or clemency of their foes, were invited to a banquet at Damascus. The laws of hospitality were violated by promiscuous massacre. The board was spread over their fallen bodies, and the festivity of the guests was enlivened by the music of their dying groans. By the event of the civil war, the dynasty of the Abbasides was firmly established. But the Christians only could triumph in the mutual hatred and common loss of the disciples of Muhammad. Yet the thousands who were swept away by the sword of war might have been speedily retrieved in the succeeding generation, if the consequences of the revolution had not tended to dissolve the power and unity of the empire of the Saracens. In the proscription of the Ommiades, a royal youth of the name of Abdalrahman alone escaped the rage of his enemies, who hunted the wandering exile from the banks of the Euphrates to the valleys of Mount Atlas. His presence in the neighborhood of Spain revived the zeal of the white faction. The name and cause of the Abbasides had been first vindicated by the Persians. The West had been pure from civil arms, and the servants of the abdicated family still held by precarious tenure the inheritance of their lands and the offices of government. Strongly prompted by gratitude, indignation, and fear, they invited the grandson of the Caliph Hashem to ascend the throne of his ancestors, and in his desperate condition, the extremes of rashness and prudence were almost the same. The acclamations of the people saluted his landing on the coast of Andalusia, and after a successful struggle, Abdalrahman established the throne of Cordoba, and was the father of the Ommiades of Spain, who reigned above 250 years from the Atlantic to the Pyrenees. He slew in battle a lieutenant of the Abbasides, who had invaded his dominions with a fleet and army. The head of Allah, in salt and camphor, was suspended by daring messenger before the palace of Mecca. Then the Caliph Al-Mansur rejoiced in his safety that he was removed by seas and lands from such a formidable adversary. Their mutual designs or declarations of offensive war evaporated without effect, but instead of opening a door to the conquest of Europe, Spain was dissevered from the trunk of the monarchy, engaged in perpetual hostility with the East, and inclined to peace and friendship with the Christian sovereigns of Constantinople and France. The example of the Ommiades was imitated by the real or fictitious progeny of Ali, the Idrisites of Mauritania, and the more powerful Fatimites of Africa and Egypt. In the 10th century, the chair of Muhammad was disputed by three caliphs or commanders of the faithful, who reigned at Baghdad, Qayrun, and Cordova, excommunicating each other, and agreed only in a principle of discord that a sectary is more odious and criminal than an unbeliever. Mecca was the patrimony of the line of Hashim, yet the Abbasides were never tempted to reside either in the birthplace or the city of the Prophet. Damascus was disgraced by the choice and polluted with the blood of the Ommiades, and after some hesitation, Al-Mansur, the brother and successor of Safah, laid the foundations of Baghdad, the imperial seat of his posterity during a reign of 500 years. The chosen spot is on the eastern bank of the Tigris, about 15 miles above the ruins of Modain. The double wall was of a circular form, and such was the rapid increase of a capital, now dwindled to a provincial town, that the funeral of a popular saint might be attended by 800,000 men and 60,000 women of Baghdad and the adjacent villages. In this city of peace, amidst the riches of the East, the Abbasides soon disdained the abstinence and frugality of the first caliphs, and aspired to emulate the magnificence of the Persian kings. After his wars and buildings, Al-Mansur left behind him in gold and silver about 30 millions sterling, and this treasure was exhausted in a few years by the vices or virtues of his children. His son Mahadi, in a single pilgrimage to Mecca, expended 6 millions of dinars of gold. A pious and charitable motive may sanctify the foundation of cisterns and caravanserais, which he distributed along a measured road of 700 miles. But his train of camels, laden with snow, could serve only to astonish the natives of Arabia and to refresh the fruits and liquors of the royal banquet. The courtiers would surely praise the liberality of his grandson, Al-Mamun, who gave away 4/5 of the income of a province, a sum of 2,400,000 gold dinars, before he drew his foot from the stirrup. At the nuptials of the same prince, 1,000 pearls of the largest size were showered on the head of the bride, and a lottery of lands and houses displayed the capricious bounty of fortune. The glories of the court were brightened, rather than impaired, in the decline of the empire, and a Greek ambassador might admire or pity the magnificence of the feeble Muqtadir. "The caliph's whole army," says the historian Abul Feda, "both horse and foot, was under arms, which together made a body of 160,000 men. His state officers, the favorite slaves, stood near him in splendid apparel, their belts glittering with gold and gems. Near them was 7,000 eunuchs, 4,000 of them white, the remainder black. The porters or doorkeepers were in number 700. Barges and boats with the most superb decorations were seen swimming upon the Tigris. Nor was the palace itself less splendid, in which were hung up 38,000 pieces of tapestry, 12,500 of which were of silk embroidered with gold. The carpets on the floor were 22,000. 100 lions were brought out, with a keeper to each lion. Among the other spectacles of rare and stupendous luxury was a tree of gold and silver spreading into 18 large branches, on which, and on the lesser boughs, sat a variety of birds made of the same precious metals as well as the leaves of the tree. While the machinery affected spontaneous motions, the several birds warbled their natural harmony. Through this scene of magnificence, the Greek ambassador was led by the vizier to the foot of the caliph's throne." In the west, the Umayyads of Spain supported with equal pomp the title of Commander of the Faithful. 3 miles from Cordova, in honor of his favorite Sultana, the third and greatest of the Abd al-Rahmans, constructed the city, palace, and gardens of Zahra. 25 years and above 3 million sterling were employed by the founder. His liberal taste invited the artists of Constantinople, the most skillful sculptors and architects of the age, and the buildings were sustained or adorned by 1,200 columns of Spanish and African, of Greek and Italian marble. The Hall of Audience was encrusted with gold and pearls, and a great basin in the center was surrounded with the curious and costly figures of birds and quadrupeds. In a lofty pavilion of the gardens, one of these basins and fountains, so delightful in a sultry climate, was replenished not with water, but with the purest quicksilver. The seraglio of Abd al-Rahman, his wives, concubines, and black eunuchs, amounted to 6,300 persons, and he was attended to the field by a guard of 12,000 horse, whose belts and scimitars were studded with gold. In a private condition, our desires are perpetually repressed by poverty and subordination. But the lives and labors of millions are devoted to the service of a despotic prince, whose laws are blindly obeyed and whose wishes are instantly gratified. Our imagination is dazzled by the splendid picture, and whatever may be the cool dictates of reason, there are few among us who would obstinately refuse a trial of the comforts and the cares of royalty. It may therefore be of some use to borrow the experience of the same Abd al-Rahman, whose magnificence has perhaps excited our admiration and envy, and to transcribe an authentic memorial which was found in the closet of the deceased caliph. I have now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace, beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honors, power and pleasure, have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. In this situation I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. They amount to 14. O man, place not thy confidence in this present world. The luxury of the caliphs, so useless to their private happiness, relaxed the nerves and terminated the progress of the Arabian Empire. Temporal and spiritual conquest had been the sole occupation of the first successors of Muhammad, and after supplying themselves with the necessaries of life, the whole revenue was scrupulously devoted to that salutary work. The Abbasides were impoverished by the multitude of their wants and their contempt of economy. Instead of pursuing the great object of ambition, their leisure, their affections, the powers of their mind, were diverted by pomp and pleasure. The rewards of valor were embezzled by women and eunuchs, and the royal camp was encumbered by the luxury of the palace. A similar temper was diffused among the subjects of the caliph. Their stern enthusiasm was softened by time and prosperity. They sought riches in the occupations of industry, fame in the pursuits of literature, and happiness in the tranquility of domestic life. War was no longer the passion of the Saracens, and the increase of pay, the repetition of donatives, were insufficient to allure the posterity of those voluntary champions who had crowded to the standard of Abu Bakr and Omar for the hopes of spoil and of paradise. Under the reign of the Umayyads, the studies of the Muslims were confined to the interpretation of the Qur'an and the eloquence and poetry of their native tongue. A people continually exposed to the dangers of the field must esteem the healing powers of medicine, or rather of surgery. But the starving physicians of Arabia murmured a complaint that exercise and temperance deprived them of the greatest part of their practice. After their civil and domestic wars, the subjects of the Abbasides, awakening from this mental lethargy, found leisure and felt curiosity for the acquisition of profane science. This spirit was first encouraged by the Caliph Al-Mansur, who, besides his knowledge of the Mohammedan law, had applied himself with success to the study of astronomy. But when the scepter devolved to Al-Mamun, the seventh of the Abbasides, he completed the designs of his grandfather and invited the muses from their ancient seats. His ambassadors at Constantinople, his agents in Armenia, Syria, and Egypt, collected the volumes of Grecian science. At his command, they were translated by the most skillful interpreters into the Arabic language. His subjects were exhorted assiduously to peruse these instructive writings, and the successor of Muhammad assisted with pleasure and modesty at the assemblies and disputations of the learned. "He was not ignorant," says Abul Faragius, "that they are the elect of God, his best and most useful servants, whose lives are devoted to the improvement of their rational faculties." The mean ambition of the Chinese or the Turks may glory in the industry of their hands or the indulgence of their brutal appetites. Yet these dexterous artists must view with hopeless emulation the hexagons and pyramids of the cells of a beehive. These fortitudinous heroes are awed by the superior fierceness of the lions and tigers, and in their amorous enjoyments they are much inferior to the vigor of the grossest and most sordid quadrupeds. The teachers of wisdom are the true luminaries and legislators of a world which, without their aid, would again sink in ignorance and barbarism. The zeal and curiosity of Al-Mamun were imitated by succeeding princes of the line of Abbas. Their rivals, the Fatimites of Africa and the Umayyads of Spain, were the patrons of the learned, as well as the commanders of the faithful. The same royal prerogative was claimed by their independent emirs of the provinces, and their emulation diffused the taste and the rewards of science from Samarkand and Bukhara to Fez and Cordova. The vizier of a sultan consecrated a sum of 200,000 pieces of gold to the foundation of a college at Baghdad, which he endowed with an annual revenue of 15,000 dinars. The fruits of instruction were communicated, perhaps at different times, to 6,000 disciples of every degree, from the son of the noble to that of the mechanic. A sufficient allowance was provided for the indigent scholars, and the merit or industry of the professors was repaid with adequate stipends. In every city, the productions of Arabic literature were copied and collected by the curiosity of the studious and the vanity of the rich. A private doctor refused the invitation of the Sultan of Bukhara because the carriage of his books would have required 400 camels. The royal library of the Fatimites consisted of 100,000 manuscripts, elegantly transcribed and splendidly bound, which were lent, without jealousy or avarice, to the students of Cairo. Yet this collection must appear moderate if we can believe that the Umayyads of Spain had formed a library of 600,000 volumes, 44 of which were employed in the mere catalogue. Their capital, Cordova, with the adjacent towns of Malaga, Almeria, and Murcia, had given birth to more than 300 writers, and above 70 public libraries were opened in the cities of the Andalusian kingdom. The age of Arabian learning continued about 500 years, till the great eruption of the Moguls, and was coeval with the darkest and most slothful period of European annals. But since the sun of science has arisen in the West, it should seem that the Oriental studies have languished and declined. In the libraries of the Arabians, as in those of Europe, the far greater part of the innumerable volumes were possessed only of local value or imaginary merit. The shelves were crowded with orators and poets whose style was adapted to the taste and manners of their countrymen, with general and partial histories, which each revolving generation supplied with a new harvest of persons and events, with codes and commentaries of jurisprudence, which derived their authority from the law of the Prophet, with the interpreters of the Koran and Orthodox tradition, and with the whole theological tribe, polemics, mystics, scholastics, and moralists, the first or the last of writers, according to the different estimates of skeptics or believers. The works of speculation or science may be reduced to the four classes of philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and physic. The sages of Greece were translated and illustrated in the Arabic language, and some treatises, now lost in the original, have been recovered in the versions of the East, which possessed and studied the writings of Aristotle and Plato, of Euclid and Apollonius, of Ptolemy, Hippocrates, and Galen. Among the ideal systems which have varied with the fashion of the times, the Arabians adopted the philosophy of the Stagirite, alike intelligible or alike obscure for the readers of every age. Plato wrote for the Athenians, and his allegorical genius is too closely blended with the language and religion of Greece. After the fall of that religion, the Peripatetics, emerging from their obscurity, prevailed in the controversies of the Oriental sects, and their founder was long afterwards restored by the Mohammedans of Spain to the Latin schools. The physics, both of the Academy and the Lyceum, as they are built not on observation but on argument, have retarded the progress of real knowledge. The metaphysics of infinite or finite spirit have too often been enlisted in the service of superstition. But the human faculties are fortified by the art and practice of dialectics. The 10 predicaments of Aristotle collect and methodize our ideas, and his syllogism is the keenest weapon of dispute. It was dexterously wielded in the schools of the Saracens, but as it is more effectual for the detection of error than for the investigation of truth, it is not surprising that new generations of masters and disciples should still revolve in the same circle of logical argument. The mathematics are distinguished by a peculiar privilege, that in the course of ages they may always advance and can never recede. But the ancient geometry, if I am not misinformed, was resumed in the same state by the Italians of the 15th century. And whatever may be the origin of the name, the science of algebra is ascribed to the Grecian Diophantus by the modest testimony of the Arabs themselves. They cultivated with more success the sublime science of astronomy, which elevates the mind of man to disdain his diminutive planet and momentary existence. The costly instruments of observation were supplied by the Caliph Al-Ma'mun, and the land of the Chaldeans still afforded the same spacious level, the same unclouded horizon. In the plains of Sinar, and a second time in those of Kufa, his mathematicians accurately measured a degree of the great circle of the earth and determined at 24,000 miles the entire circumference of our globe. From the reign of the Abbasides to that of the grandchildren of Tamerlane, the stars, without the aid of glasses, were diligently observed, and the astronomical tables of Baghdad, Spain, and Samarkand correct some minute errors without daring to renounce the hypothesis of Ptolemy, without advancing a step towards the discovery of the solar system. In the Eastern courts, the truths of science could be recommended only by ignorance and folly, and the astronomer would have been disregarded had he not debased his wisdom or honesty by the vain predictions of astrology. But in the science of medicine, the Arabians have been deservedly applauded. The names of Messua and Geber, of Razis and Avicenna, are ranked with the Grecian masters. In the city of Baghdad, 860 physicians were licensed to exercise their lucrative profession. In Spain, the life of the Catholic princes was entrusted to the skill of the Saracens, and the school of Salerno, their legitimate offspring, revived in Italy and Europe the precepts of the healing art. The success of each professor must have been influenced by personal and accidental causes, but we may form a less fanciful estimate of their general knowledge of anatomy, botany, and chemistry, the threefold basis of their theory and practice. A superstitious reverence for the dead confined both the Greeks and the Arabians to the dissection of apes and quadrupeds. The more solid and visible parts were known in the time of Galen, and the finer scrutiny of the human frame was reserved for the microscope and the injections of modern artists. Botany is an active science, and the discoveries of the torrid zone might enrich the herbal of Dioscorides with 2,000 plants. Some traditionary knowledge might be secreted in the temples and monasteries of Egypt. Much useful experience has been acquired in the practice of arts and manufactures. But the science of chemistry owes its origin and improvement to the industry of the Saracens. They first invented and named the alembic for the purposes of distillation, analyzed the substances of the three kingdoms of nature, tried the distinction and affinities of alkalis and acids, and converted the poisonous minerals into soft and salutary medicines. But the most eager search of Arabian chemistry was the transmutation of metals and the elixir of immortal health. The reason and the fortunes of thousands were evaporated in the crucibles of alchemy, and the consummation of the great work was promoted by the worthy aid of mystery, fable, and superstition. But the Muslims deprived themselves of the principal benefits of a familiar intercourse with Greece and Rome, the knowledge of antiquity, the purity of taste, and the freedom of thought. Confident in the riches of their native tongue, the Arabians disdained the study of any foreign idiom. The Greek interpreters were chosen among their Christian subjects. They formed their translations, sometimes on the original text, more frequently perhaps on a Syriac version, and in the crowd of astronomers and physicians there is no example of a poet, an orator, or even an historian being taught to speak the language of the Saracens. The mythology of Homer would have provoked the abhorrence of those stern fanatics. They possessed, in lazy ignorance, the colonies of the Macedonians and the provinces of Carthage and Rome. The heroes of Plutarch and Livy were buried in oblivion, and the history of the world before Muhammad was reduced to a short legend of the patriarchs, the prophets, and the Persian kings. Our education in the Greek and Latin schools may have fixed in our minds a standard of exclusive taste, and I am not forward to condemn the literature and judgment of nations of whose language I am ignorant. Yet I know that the classics have much to teach, and I believe that the Orientals have much to learn. The temperate dignity of style, the graceful proportions of art, the forms of visible and intellectual beauty, the just delineation of character and passion, the rhetoric of narrative and argument, the regular fabric of epic and dramatic poetry. The influence of truth and reason is of a less ambiguous complexion. The philosophers of Athens and Rome enjoyed the blessings and asserted the rights of civil and religious freedom. Their moral and political writings might have gradually unlocked the fetters of Eastern despotism, diffused a liberal spirit of inquiry and toleration, and encouraged the Arabian sages to suspect that their caliph was a tyrant and their prophet an impostor. The instinct of superstition was alarmed by the introduction even of the abstract sciences, and the more rigid doctors of the law condemned the rash and pernicious curiosity of Al-Mamun. To the thirst of martyrdom, the vision of paradise, and the belief of predestination, we must ascribe the invincible enthusiasm of the prince and people. And the sword of the Saracens became less formidable when their youth was drawn away from the camp to the college, when the armies of the faithful presumed to read and to reflect. Yet the foolish vanity of the Greeks was jealous of their studies and reluctantly imparted the sacred fire to the barbarians of the East. In the bloody conflict of the Umayyads and Abbasids, the Greeks had stolen the opportunity of avenging their wrongs and enlarging their limits. But a severe retribution was exacted by Mohadi, the third caliph of the new dynasty, who seized in his turn the favorable opportunity, while a woman and a child, Irene and Constantine, were seated on the Byzantine throne. An army of 95,000 Persians and Arabs was sent from the Tigris to the Thracian Bosphorus under the command of Harun, or Aaron, the second son of the commander of the faithful. His encampment on the opposite heights of Chrysopolis, or Scutari, informed Irene in her palace of Constantinople of the loss of her troops and provinces. With the consent or connivance of their sovereign, her ministers subscribed an ignominious peace, and the exchange of some royal gifts could not disguise the annual tribute of 70,000 dinars of gold, which was imposed on the Roman Empire. The Saracens had too rashly advanced into the midst of a distant and hostile land. Their retreat was solicited by the promise of faithful guides and plentiful markets. And not a Greek had courage to whisper that their weary forces might be surrounded and destroyed in their necessary passage between a slippery mountain and the river Sangarius. 5 years after this expedition, Harun ascended the throne of his father and his elder brother. The most powerful and vigorous monarch of his race, illustrious in the West as the ally of Charlemagne, and familiar to the most childish readers as the perpetual hero of the Arabian tales. His title to the name of Al-Rashid, the Just, is sullied by the extirpation of the generous, perhaps the innocent, Barmecides. Yet he could listen to the complaint of a poor widow who had been pillaged by his troops, and who dared, in a passage of the Quran, to threaten the inattentive despots with the judgment of God and posterity. His court was adorned with luxury and science, but in a reign of 23 years, Harun repeatedly visited his provinces from Khorasan to Egypt. 9 times he performed the pilgrimage of Mecca, 8 times he invaded the territories of the Romans, and as often as they declined the payment of the tribute, they were taught to feel that a month of depredation was more costly than a year of submission. But when the unnatural mother of Constantine was deposed and banished, her successor, Nicephorus, resolved to obliterate this badge of servitude and disgrace. The epistle of the emperor to the caliph was pointed with an allusion to the game of chess, which had already spread from Persia to Greece. "The queen," he spoke of Irene, "considered you as a rook and herself as a pawn. That pusillanimous female submitted to pay a tribute, the double of which she ought to have exacted from the barbarians. Restore, therefore, the fruits of your injustice, or abide the determination of the sword." At these words the ambassadors cast a bundle of swords before the foot of the throne. The caliph smiled at the menace, and, drawing his scimitar, Samsamah, a weapon of historic or fabulous renown, he cut asunder the feeble arms of the Greeks, without turning the edge or endangering the temper of his blade. He then dictated an epistle of tremendous brevity. "In the name of the most merciful God, Harun al-Rashid, commander of the faithful, to Nicephorus, the Roman dog, I have read thy letter, O thou son of an unbelieving mother. Thou shalt not hear, thou shalt behold my reply." It was written in characters of blood and fire on the plains of Phrygia, and the warlike celerity of the Arabs could only be checked by the arts of deceit and the show of repentance. The triumphant caliph retired, after the fatigues of the campaign, to his favorite palace of Raqqa on the Euphrates. But the distance of 500 miles and the inclemency of the season encouraged his adversary to violate the peace. Nicephorus was astonished by the bold and rapid march of the commander of the faithful, who repassed in the depth of winter the snows of Mount Taurus. His stratagems of policy and war were exhausted, and the perfidious Greek escaped with 3 wounds from a field of battle overspread with 40,000 of his subjects. Yet the emperor was ashamed of submission, and the caliph was resolved on victory. 135,000 regular soldiers received pay and were inscribed in the military roll, and above 300,000 persons of every denomination marched under the black standard of the Abbasides. They swept the surface of Asia Minor far beyond Tyana and Ancyra, and invested the Pontic Heraclea, once a flourishing state, now a paltry town. At that time, capable of sustaining in her antique walls a month's siege against the forces of the East. The ruin was complete, the spoil was ample, but if Harun had been conversant with Grecian story, he would have regretted the statue of Hercules, whose attributes, the club, the bow, the quiver, and the lion's hide, were sculptured in massy gold. The progress of desolation by sea and land, from the Black Sea to the Isle of Cyprus, compelled the Emperor Nicephorus to retract his haughty defiance. In the new treaty, the ruins of Heraclea were left forever as a lesson and a trophy, and the coin of the tribute was marked with the image and superscription of Harun and his three sons. Yet this plurality of lords might contribute to remove the dishonor of the Roman name. After the death of their father, the heirs of the caliph were involved in civil discord, and the conqueror, the liberal Al-Ma'mun, was sufficiently engaged in the restoration of domestic peace and the introduction of foreign science. Under the reign of Al-Ma'mun at Baghdad, of Michael the Stammerer at Constantinople, the islands of Crete and Sicily were subdued by the Arabs. The former of these conquests is disdained by their own writers, who were ignorant of the fame of Jupiter and Minos, but it has not been overlooked by the Byzantine historians, who now begin to cast a clearer light on the affairs of their own times. A band of Andalusian volunteers, discontented with the climate or government of Spain, explored the adventures of the sea, but as they sailed in no more than 10 or 20 galleys, their warfare must be branded with the name of piracy. As the subjects and sectaries of the White Party, they might lawfully invade the dominions of the Black Caliphs. A rebellious faction introduced them into Alexandria. They cut in pieces both friends and foes, pillaged the churches and the mosques, sold above 6,000 Christian captives, and maintained their station in the capital of Egypt till they were oppressed by the forces and the presence of Al-Ma'mun himself. From the mouth of the Nile to the Hellespont, the islands and sea coasts, both of the Greeks and Muslims, were exposed to their depredations. They saw, they envied, they tasted the fertility of Crete, and soon returned with 40 galleys to a more serious attack. The Andalusians wandered over the land, fearless and unmolested, but when they descended with their plunder to the seashore, their vessels were in flames, and their chief, Abu Ka'b, confessed himself the author of the mischief. Their clamors accused his madness or treachery. "Of what do you complain?" replied the crafty emir. "I have brought you to a land flowing with milk and honey. Here is your true country. Repose from your toils, and forget the barren place of your nativity. And our wives and children? Your beauteous captives will supply the place of your wives. And in their embraces, you will soon become the fathers of a new progeny." The first habitation was their camp, with a ditch and rampart, in the Bay of Suda. But an apostate monk led them to a more desirable position in the eastern parts, and the name of Kandax, their fortress and colony, has been extended to the whole island under the corrupt and modern appellation of Candia. The 100 cities of the age of Minos were diminished to 30, and of these only one, most probably Cydonia, had courage to retain the substance of freedom and the profession of Christianity. The Saracens of Crete soon repaired the loss of their navy, and timbers of Mount Ida were launched into the main. During a hostile period of 130 years, the princes of Constantinople attacked these licentious corsairs with fruitless curses and ineffectual arms. The loss of Sicily was occasioned by an act of superstitious rigor. An amorous youth who had stolen a nun from her cloister was sentenced by the emperor to the amputation of his tongue. Euphemius appealed to the reason and policy of the Saracens of Africa, and soon returned with the imperial purple, a fleet of 100 ships, and an army of 700 horse and 10,000 foot. They landed at Mazara, near the ruins of the ancient Selinus. But after some partial victories, Syracuse was delivered by the Greeks, The apostate was slain before her walls, and his African friends were reduced to the necessity of feeding on the flesh of their own horses. In their turn, they were relieved by powerful reinforcement of their brethren of Andalusia. The largest and western part of the island was gradually reduced, and the commodious harbour of Palermo was chosen for the seat of the naval and military power of the Saracens. Syracuse preserved about 50 years the faith which she had sworn to Christ and to Caesar. In the last and fatal siege, her citizens displayed some remnant of the spirit which had formerly resisted the powers of Athens and Carthage. They stood above 20 days against the battering rams and catapulto, the mines and tortoises of the besiegers, and the place might have been relieved if the mariners of the imperial fleet had not been detained at Constantinople in building a church to the Virgin Mary. The deacon Theodosius, with the bishop and clergy, was dragged in chains from the altar to Palermo, cast into a subterraneous dungeon, and exposed to the hourly peril of death or apostasy. His pathetic and not inelegant complaint may be read as the epitaph of his country. From the Roman conquest to this final calamity, Syracuse, now dwindled to the primitive isle of Ortigia, had insensibly declined. Yet the relics were still precious. The plate of the cathedral weighed 5,000 pounds of silver. The entire spoil was computed at 1,000,000 of pieces of gold, about 400,000 pounds sterling, and the captives must outnumber the 17,000 Christians who were transported from the sack of Tauromenium into African servitude. In Sicily, the religion and language of the Greeks were eradicated. And such was the docility of the rising generation that 15,000 boys were circumcised and clothed on the same day with the son of the Fatimite caliph. The Arabian squadrons issued from the harbours of Palermo, Biserta, and Tunis. 150 towns of Calabria and Campania were attacked and pillaged. Nor could the suburbs of Rome be defended by the name of the Caesars and Apostles. Had the Mohammedans been united, Italy must have fallen an easy and glorious accession to the empire of the Prophet. But the caliphs of Baghdad had lost their authority in the West. The Aghlabites and Fatimites usurped the provinces of Africa. Their emirs of Sicily aspired to independence, and the design of conquest and dominion was degraded to a repetition of predatory inroads. In the sufferings of prostrate Italy, the name of Rome awakens a solemn and mournful recollection. A fleet of Saracens from the African coast presumed to enter the mouth of the Tiber, and to approach a city which even yet, in her fallen state, was revered as the metropolis of the Christian world. The gates and ramparts were guarded by trembling people, but the tombs and temples of St. Peter and St. Paul were left exposed in the suburbs of the Vatican and of the Ostian Way. Their invisible sanctity had protected them against the Goths, the Vandals, and the Lombards. But the Arabs disdained both the gospel and the legend, and their rapacious spirit was approved and animated by the precepts of the Quran. The Christian idols were stripped of their costly offerings. A silver altar was torn away from the shrine of St. Peter, and if the bodies or the buildings were left entire, their deliverance must be imputed to the haste rather than the scruples of the Saracens. In their course along the Appian Way, they pillaged Fundi and besieged Gaeta. But they had turned aside from the walls of Rome, and by their divisions, the capital was saved from the yoke of the prophet of Mecca. The same danger still impended on the heads of the Roman people, and their domestic force was unequal to the assault of an African emir. They claimed the protection of their Latin sovereign. but the Carlovingian standard was overthrown by a detachment of the barbarians. They meditated the restoration of the Greek emperors, but the attempt was treasonable, and the succour remote and precarious. Their distress appeared to receive some aggravation from the death of their spiritual and temporal chief, but the pressing emergency superseded the forms and intrigues of an election, and the unanimous choice of Pope Leo IV was the safety of the church and city. This pontiff was born a Roman. The courage of the first ages of the Republic glowed in his breast, and amidst the ruins of his country he stood erect, like one of the firm and lofty columns that rear their heads above the fragments of the Roman Forum. The first days of his reign were consecrated to the purification and removal of relics, to prayers and processions, and to all the solemn offices of religion which served at least to heal the imagination and restore the hopes of the multitude. The public defense had been long neglected, not from the presumption of peace, but from the distress and poverty of the times. As far as the scantiness of his means and the shortness of his leisure would allow, the ancient walls were repaired by the command of Leo. 15 towers in the most accessible stations were built or renewed. 2 of these commanded on either side of the Tiber, and an iron chain was drawn across the stream to impede the ascent of a hostile navy. The Romans were assured of a short respite by the welcome news that the siege of Gaeta had been raised, and that a part of the enemy, with their sacrilegious plunder, had perished in the waves. But the storm which had been delayed soon burst upon them with redoubled violence. The Aglabite, who reigned in Africa, had inherited from his father a treasure and an army. A fleet of Arabs and Moors, after a short refreshment in the harbours of Sardinia, cast anchor before the mouth of the Tiber, 16 miles from the city. And their discipline and numbers appeared to threaten not a transient inroad, but a serious design of conquest and dominion. But the vigilance of Leo had formed an alliance with the vassals of the Greek Empire, the free and maritime states of Gaeta, Naples, and Amalfi. And in the hour of danger, their galleys appeared in the port of Ostia under the command of Caesarius, the son of the Neapolitan duke, a noble and valiant youth who had already vanquished the fleets of the Saracens. With his principal companions, Caesarius was invited to the Lateran palace, and the dexterous pontiff affected to inquire their errand, and to accept with joy and surprise their providential succour. The city bands, in arms, attended their father to Ostia, where he reviewed and blessed his generous deliverers. They kissed his feet, received the communion with martial devotion, and listened to the prayer of Leo that the same God who had supported St. Peter and St. Paul on the waves of the sea would strengthen the hands of his champions against the adversaries of his holy name. After a similar prayer, and with equal resolution, the Muslims advanced to the attack of the Christian galleys, which preserved their advantageous station along the coast. The victory inclined to the side of the allies, when it was less gloriously decided in their favour by a sudden tempest, which confounded the skill and courage of the stoutest mariners. The Christians were sheltered in a friendly harbour, while the Africans were scattered and dashed in pieces among the rocks and islands of a hostile shore. Those who